The R.R. Campbell Writes Cast is brought to you in part by listeners like you. Learn more about the great rewards available to Writes Cast contributors by visiting patreon.com/writescast. Thanks for listening. Hey, hi, hello, and welcome to episode 11 of the R.R. Campbell Writes Cast. I'm R.R. Campbell. For this episode, I spoke with fantasy and science fiction author Danielle Maurer about Twitter contests, developing good writing habits, and working with an editor. As a winner of this year's Revise and Resubmit, or RevPit, competition, and a fellow Son of a Pitch finalist, Danielle has a ton of great perspective to offer on all of those topics and more, which we'll get to shortly. Before we get started with the interview, however, I do have one exciting bit of news. I'm pleased to announce that my flash fiction piece, Wool, is now available to read and listen to via 521 Magazine. If you're interested in checking it out, you can click the link in the show notes on rrcampbellwrites.com or head on over to 521's website at 521magazine.com. Wool is the short story of a young child's first unexpected experience with poverty, and I'd love to know how you enjoy it after checking it out. Again, you can find that in the section titled The Sideshow at 521magazine.com. That's the word 5, the number 2, and the word 1 magazine. That being said, it's now time for this WritesCast interview with Danielle Maurer. Stay tuned on the backside of the interview for more news on the future of WritesCast. And thanks, as always, for listening. Well, thank you, Danielle, for joining me today on the show.
Thank you for having me, Ryan. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. So let's jump in right away, and we'll talk a little bit about the journey that led you to your Revise and Resubmit, or RevPit, experience.
Sure. So I've been working on this particular novel for about 14 years. Sounds like an awfully long time.
Yeah, it sure does.
I was about 12 years worth of plotting and writing and drafting, and about 2-ish years of editing work.
Wow.
And after I had finished all of that, I thought I was ready to query. I was really sure I was ready to query. And I sent out my first wave of query letters to a bunch of agents, and they all came, almost all of them came back within 3 days as rejections.
Wow.
Yeah, it was very, very much a reality check. And I realized I needed to get some more feedback on my query before I, quote unquote, burned any more agents.
Yeah.
So I started looking for places where I could get that. I posted the query in some writing groups that I'm a member of. That was very helpful. I sought some editorial feedback on the query in the first page, which was also very helpful. I took the first pages to a critique group. They had some good comments. And as part of that journey, I started getting more involved with Twitter and the contests that are frequently hosted there. So I did Son of a Pitch, which I know you also did.
Yep.
Which I was a finalist in, and that was a great help, particularly for the query letter. I submitted to Pitch Madness, which, you know, there's so many people that do Pitch Madness. I really didn't expect to get anything out of that, and I didn't. I did Passer Pages, which is another contest where you post your query letter in your first, I want to say, 250 words, and there's an anonymous agent who comes through and reads them and provides feedback. Yeah, that was actually really good. I got mostly positive feedback, but there was one really, really huge problem with the query at that point, which it helped me identify that. And then I finally entered RevPit, and I honestly didn't expect to get chosen. I was actually very, very surprised on the day when the winners were announced and my name was on them.
Yeah, that was a huge deal. I remember seeing that because, you know, I entered that one as well. And there was that sort of like, it just kind of felt like writing Twitter was on pause, like the world was watching kind of thing. And then when I saw your Twitter handle come up, I was like, oh, my God, yes, that's so great. I feel like I like messaged you immediately and was so excited.
You did.
Yeah, that was so great to see. I was just like, that's so, because, you know, you enter contests like that, whether it's Pitch Madness or you and I were both, you know, both were finalists for Son of a Pitch, which was, like you said, a great experience. But then you see all these other really big ones and you're like, oh man, it's cool that it happened for them. But when it actually happens for someone, you know, it's so like, oh my God, yes, it's, I don't know.
It's
there's
a
just that
personal, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something that I think Meg Gertner talked about in a recent episode of the podcast where, like, you know, if you have that strong writing community, we're there for one another through all those rejections, but we're also there to celebrate those successes. And it was so awesome to see that you had the opportunity to really get that great editing work and work along Kisa as part of the RevPit.
Absolutely. It's there's really a strong community that goes into those Twitter contests, because you start seeing the same names and the same manuscripts come up, and you start developing an attachment to them as you learn more about them, and you're rooting for your friends who are submitting to the same contest that you are. So it's very positive when you see someone, even if it's not you, it's still a good feeling to know that someone you know is making progress.
Definitely. And that actually ties into, I think, the next part of this conversation that I wanted to have here, was that it seems like getting involved in the community, whether it's on, you know, Twitter seems to be particularly effective. I know there are some groups on Facebook now. There's the Red Pen Club that you and I are both a part of. They can be really effective ways to put yourself in a good position to get the feedback that you need to move on. So it sounds like those sorts of things have worked for you. Are there some things that you've tried that didn't, that maybe kind of came up short in terms of the return you felt you got on those? Or are there other places you'd encourage listeners to get involved with to continue to hone their craft?
Well, one thing that definitely was a big positive for me, it was National Novel Writing Month. And I know probably everyone who listens to this podcast knows this, but in case you don't, National Novel Writing Month is November, where you are supposed to write 50,000 words in a single month. And that sounds intimidating to a lot of people, but I failed at it several times before I finally managed to complete it once. And I actually did complete it once with this manuscript that I'm currently querying. And it taught me a lot about getting out of my own head and just getting the words on the page, which is a really valuable thing. And it's even more fun when you can do it with friends. The first time I succeeded, it was me and I want to say three other people who were all doing National Novel Writing Month at the same time. And there was something about going in there each day and seeing, oh, you know, my friend Sirocco added 2,000 words today. I got to get on it, you know, that helped me want to keep up with them and actually complete it. So that's a thing I definitely recommend trying at least once to see if it's something that can be helpful for you. Definitely prepare, though, I would say. Something that didn't work for me as well, I used something called Habit RPG for a while. And if you're not familiar with Habit RPG, it is a gamification system for habits. So you can enter in all the different things that you want to do on a daily or a weekly basis. You have a little action adventure hero type person. You can collect pets and all this stuff. But the way that you do all of that with your character and defeat the bosses in the game is by completing your habits and marking them off. And if you don't do that, your character can get damaged and eventually die. So I played this for a long time with my friends, and one of the goals that I set for myself in Habit RPG was a daily writing goal. And it worked okay for a couple of months until kind of life events forced me out of it. It starts to get a bit discouraging after a while if you just don't have the time to do it. So I ended up kind of moving away from that. But if gamification is your thing, Habit RPG is pretty cool.
That does sound really neat. I can see, though, how if you're going to compare something like Habit RPG to NaNoWriMo, you know, in NaNoWriMo, when you're writing alongside other folks or you're following them, there's a lot of positive reinforcement there, I feel, and that, like you mentioned, you see other people are succeeding, they're hitting their word target goals and exceeding them, and that is a motivator, it sounds like, to keep you wanting to stay on that same pace. Whereas with Habit RPG, when you have things like damage being done to your character, especially if it's, you know, circumstances beyond your control are preventing you from playing, quote unquote, I can see how that negative reinforcement could become a little burdensome eventually.
And it really comes down to what your personal preferences are. I mean, for me, the positive reinforcement and the competition with my friends was enough to really motivate me to move forward. The negative reinforcement didn't work quite as well for me. You know, there are people for whom that kind of sort of Damocles, I guess, hanging over their head can actually be a good motivator. So I guess it depends on the person. It wasn't something that worked for me, but if that's your thing, I would encourage you to take a look at the program. It's actually pretty cool.
I think that speaks really well to the idea of just trying to find what works best for you. I mean, because every writer is going to have a different experience in terms of, are they the kind of person that's going to write every day for an hour, or are you the person that's going to write once a week for 5 hours? You know, we all have to find our own schedule, and we also have to find our own system that works for us. And I think that your journey, insofar as you've related, it's really a testament to you just have to try everything until it works, basically.
Pretty much. You have to find that thing that works for you. And along the way, you're going to find a lot of things that don't. Like with this particular manuscript, because of how long it took me to write it, I had to constantly redraft the book, because I would grow as a writer and then the chapters wouldn't match anymore and I would need to go back and fix it. And while it was a thing that I definitely had to do, I did not like having to redraft the entire book multiple times. So going forward for me, I'm probably going to stick to getting a full draft out as quickly as possible and then just editing that draft instead of having to completely redraft. But there are people who love redrafting, and you know, you just kind of have to find the things that work for you as a writer.
Yeah, and talking about that redrafting process, legend has it that over the course of, you know, you spent 12 years writing this, of course, it sounds like you've done 2 years of editing it. Part of that process, it sounded like you had to do a really intense shaving down of the word count. How many words did you actually cut to get to where you are now?
So right now, the original query ready, quote unquote, draft was 173,000 words, which sounds way out there. I do write fantasy, but it's still very long. Mm-hmm. I trimmed 43,000 words before I entered RevPit. And actually now with some of the edits I've done with Kisa, I'm up to about 49,000 words trimmed.
I mean, that's a lot of, those are a lot of words to take out of there. What was your overall approach to do that? I mean, how do you go about cutting such a significant volume of your manuscript? Was it a lot of like eliminating unnecessary words, or was it a matter of getting those scenes kind of tighter and getting rid of some of the fat, so to speak?
It was a little bit of both. There was a lot of eliminating unnecessary words and tightening up prose. Someone read, I think it was a query letter of mine, and gave me what was probably the most useful advice someone said to me, which was that my extra calories were in my prepositional phrases. And so with that in my head, I went back through the manuscript and was like, okay, where do I have prepositional phrases that are redundant or that I don't need, that I can take out, which aren't really adding anything to the story? Similar to that, I took out a lot of that's, ups, downs, you know, the words that we include the first time through, but that we don't actually need. I made sure that there were contractions in the dialogue, not only to trim the word count, but also to make sure that the dialogue sounds natural because we speak with contractions. Mm-hmm. I eliminated a lot of passive voice that I found where I could, that always cuts out words. There were a few big edits I made. I did take out some extraneous world building or sections that felt a little bit redundant and didn't deliver anything new as much as they just extra reinforced something that I had already done. The biggest edits that I made, I removed an entire point of view that just, it only existed for about a third of the book and it wasn't really adding anything. The important information in those scenes could be covered elsewhere. So I scrapped that entire point of view, and I also completely took out my existing prologue, interludes, and epilogue to pull a new one out of text that I already had. So that also eliminated, I don't know, probably 7,000 or 8,000 words in one go.
So did you have, as the manuscript stands right now, does it have just the one point of view and you just had that second one that was there as an accessory, or are there still multiple points of view to it?
Ooh, there's still multiple points of view. I think I have 7 right now, actually. Oh. In the book. And part of that is simply because it is an ensemble cast. And so in order to really get into these characters' heads, I needed to have more point of views. At one point, it was as high as 9 point of views. And so it's come down a little bit since then.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And it's actually, I mean, that's been part of my experience as well with the novel I'm currently querying for, you know, where point of view is concerned, because I do have 4 of them. And I myself at times have questioned, are all 4 necessary? Do I need to get rid of one entirely? I'll try starting a draft where I get rid of one. And of course, it saves a bunch of words. But in manuscripts like yours and hopefully mine as well, it really sounds like when you need those points of view to really flesh out the world and flesh out the story, you have to decide to keep those in there. They're a fundamental part of the plot.
Yeah, I mean, if the point of view is serving a purpose and there is a definitive reason that you have to have it that benefits the story and benefits the characters, then I would never cut a point of view just for the sake of reducing the words if it's adding something. The one that I did end up cutting, the reason I cut it was because it wasn't even a point of view that lasted the whole book. It was a point of view that didn't have a ton of scenes, and the scenes that it did have, they didn't really add anything to the plot. They didn't move the story forward strongly. And in the case of one scene, it didn't even need to be from that character's point of view. It could have been from the point of view of a different point of view character who was also in the scene, which would just tighten things up a little bit more and give readers fewer characters that they had to kind of shift into their mindset, make things a little bit simpler. So, you know, it's a balancing act. You have to take both of those things into consideration before you start looking at scrapping point of views or adding them.
And I'm sure that part of, you know, we spoke a little bit earlier about RevPit. I know that as a RevPit finalist, you had the chance to work with editor Kisa Wipke on a one-on-one basis for that entire month. What was that experience like, and how did that compare to what you were expecting? Was having her there as, you know, an editor something that helped you affirm some of the decisions you made about things like point of view and scene choice and things like that? What was that experience like overall?
It was really amazing. I cannot recommend getting an external editor highly enough, especially if you're self-publishing, but even if you're just getting ready to do the querying thing, it's invaluable because they see the things that you don't, because you're way too close to the manuscript. And because they are professional, they give you a much better idea of the structural problems within your novel and the ways to fix them than you're going to get from a beta reader or even from a critique partner in many cases. It was fairly close to what I expected. So what I won was a developmental edit, which is focusing on, you know, the big structural issues, not really line edits for the most part. And the first thing Kisa did was a full read-through of the entire manuscript. And then she spent some time kind of synthesizing the whole thing and putting together a letter of comments on everything from the world building to the plot to the pacing to the characters. The best part was she was complimentary where I deserved it. And so that was nice to get some validation for the things that I had done well. But she was also 100% honest with me when she needed to be. She was gentle about it, but she was honest. And that's the biggest value, really, is getting that honesty with someone. We went back and forth on her comments until we settled on kind of a plan of action of what I was going to do. And then I went forth and, you know, made the edits, one of which being shifting some point of views, actually. And she's doing a second read-through right now. I'm not quite done. My advice, is honestly, if you're considering this, if you're considering getting an editor, is to find someone who is as passionate about your work as you are. Look for the genres that your editor candidates like and try to find someone who matches your manuscript as closely as you can. The great thing about working with Kisa, the absolute best thing, was that I knew every suggestion she made came from a real place of love for my story and my world. So even when she was telling me things that I maybe didn't really want to hear or didn't necessarily love at first as an idea, I knew that that feedback was coming from a place of love for the manuscript and really wanting to make it better.
And I think that that's a really good piece of advice to keep with you too, because I can add to that actually, because I just had my first opportunity to work with an editor as well on Empathy, and I worked with Sion Ashleman, who is also part of RevPit, was one of the editors that I subbed to as part of that competition. And I worked with her on the side. It wasn't a full manuscript review. It was like first 50 pages plus darkest moment plus final chapters. And I had a really similar experience to what it sounds like you did. There was a lot of really opportunities. There was a lot of great opportunities to identify strengths. But also when working with an editor, it's important to remember, you know, if they're as passionate about the manuscript as you are, sometimes they're going to bring that new perspective to it. They're going to say some things that you didn't realize. And once in a while, that can be hard to swallow. But if you work with them and keep in mind that they're interested in making this the best story that they possibly can alongside you, then with enough perspective, enough time to sit down and think about it, you can really see, wow, yes, absolutely. I need to revisit this scene. I need to revisit this particular angle of my theme, whatever it might be. And I think that that's something that is so, like you said, it goes beyond the value that perhaps a beta reader might bring to it or a critique partner who might be burying themselves in the line edits a bit more.
Yeah, and it's going back to what you were just saying too, it's so critical when you work with an editor to be open to suggestions. You know, when we work with betas or critique partners, it's a lot easier to just be like, well, I don't agree with that, and you know, this is my story, whatever, because it's, you know, it's a friend or a close colleague, maybe use that word. But with the editor, you have to acknowledge that a good editor knows their job, and this is what they do, and so you can't disregard their advice without at least considering the option. You know, you may end up going down a different path in the end, but you really have to think through why they made that suggestion in the first place. There was something off that probably needs to be addressed because, like I said, they have that distance from the manuscript that you don't have, and so they can see the things that you can't. And that's a real tough skill to learn. I mean, being able to accept feedback like that, and you can only acquire that skill by actively seeking out feedback and learning to divorce your personal feelings, I guess, from your manuscript, because that's so easy to do. It's so easy to take it personally. And it really isn't. So if you're going to do it, you have to kind of get into that mindset of being open to take the suggestions and think real long and hard about why they make the comments that they do.
Yeah, I could not agree more. So let's look then at, we've talked a little bit about your journey with this manuscript overall, but what's one lesson you've learned that you would like to share with other writers who might be going through their own, you know, extended process with the same manuscript?
The absolute biggest takeaway that I've had from this 14 years of working on this book is to just get the freaking words down. Finish the book. I mean, this manuscript never should have taken me 14 years. I had all the story in my head, but I just had such real problems sitting down and writing it. And, you know, going back to what I said earlier about National Novel Writing Month, that's why it was so good for me. It really forced me to step away from my internal editor, stop being such a perfectionist, and just focus on getting the words out of my head. And, you know, set a goal. It doesn't have to be a huge goal, you know, 500 words a day, that's still progress. 100 words a day is still progress. Even 10 words a day is still progress. Whatever works for you, but you have to keep that momentum going, because when you start to lose the momentum, it's so easy to put it away for 2 years and forget about it. You know, that happened to me at one point, and I'm glad I came back to it and I finished it. But the more you can keep that momentum moving, the much, much more successful you're going to be, because you're going to actually be able to finish multiple projects and keep going.
And that's actually, I would agree 100% with that advice. It wasn't until I really put myself in a situation where I knew, I just told myself, like, I needed to write every day. And I tried to think of it in terms of, you know, 100 words a day doesn't sound like much. 1,000 words a day might not sound like much. But I mean, if you do that every day of the year, of course, you know, you're going to be taking days off. I try to give myself at least one day off a week anyway. But you can find yourself having finished half of a novel in a year, or an entire novel in a year, or two novels in an entire year, because at least I've noticed 1,000 words a day at first is a really awesome target. And that was what I was shooting for quite some time. But I've noticed now when I write in the morning, it used to be I could only get, you know, 1,000 words out in that hour. But there are some mornings now where if it flows, you can get to 2,000. You can get to maybe it's 1,800 one day, or 1,600. Mm-hmm. It builds on itself. And when you start exceeding that initial goal, you're suddenly in a position where, holy cow, between the months of February and June, you can get an entire draft of a different novel completed that you never would have seen coming if you didn't put in that work of even, you know, 1,000 words a day, 100 words a day, what have you.
Like any habit, the more you do it, the easier it gets. I mean, I'm trying to remember where it's from, but to really form a habit, you have to do it for several weeks before that kind of crystallizes in your head as a habit. So get through those early weeks of making writing a habit. However you have to do it, whether it's, I personally use the calendar system. I have a little writing calendar and I put stickers on it every day that I meet my writing goals. And I love being able to look back at the end of the month and see that calendar with all its little stickers on it and say, you know, it's a tangible piece of evidence that I made progress. So if that works for you, that's an awesome thing, but you've got to keep that momentum going. And the more you do it, the easier it's going to be, like you said, to go from writing 1,000 words in an hour to writing 2,000 words in an hour, because you can reach that flow state easier.
Yeah, certainly. And I think, too, another strategy that it sounds like you've pursued, one that's, again, more of the positive reinforcement angle. You want to be able to have that sticker on the calendar and you want to see a nice, pretty, colorful calendar by the time the month is done. For me, my strategy was associating the habit of writing every day with another habit that I knew would be better for my physical health longer term, which was, and all the dentists out there are going to love me for this, every night I would floss. I started flossing every day because I was always just like a periodic flosser for like ever. And this sounds tangential, but I swear, like, marrying these two habits together worked really well for me. It was like, I'd be really tired at night. I'd be getting ready for bed and I'd have this thought of like, oh, I just don't really want to floss. I want to go to bed. But then I was like, no, floss tonight so that you write tomorrow. And as strange as that sounded, it was just like, yeah, if I flossed and then went to bed, I'd wake up in the morning and be like, all right, I got to fulfill the other half of this habit by writing first thing in the day. So strange as that sounds, I mean, maybe trying to hitch a couple of positive habits together isn't the craziest way to get yourself moving, not only in the world of writing, but with other goals that we as individuals might have.
I absolutely agree. It sounds crazy, but it does work.
It does work. And again, maybe, you know, the strategy that you've described or the strategy that I've described now isn't going to be right for our listeners. But going back to one of the earliest points that you made was that you just have to try things until you find the one that works for you.
Yep. You got to kiss a lot of frogs.
Oh, God. Yes. That's a great way to put it. So why don't we then, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking about your manuscript in these very broad terms. So let's jump in a little bit more to talking about Prisoner of Fate, as it's called. Why don't you kind of walk us through its premise broadly, and then if you have a reading prepared, feel free to jump right in on that whenever you're ready.
Sure. So Prisoner of Fate is an adult grimdark fantasy, if you're familiar with that particular subgenre, about a nobleman having his midlife crisis, essentially. He hates his brothers and sisters. He's the third son of the family, so he hasn't really got much of a future when his father dies, and he's bored out of his mind. So when this mysterious traveler shows up and claims that our nobleman hero has been chosen to create a gem that bestows immortality, our nobleman seizes on it. He wants to leave this lasting legacy, and he gets to have something cool to shove in his brothers' faces. So, of course, things don't quite go as according to plan. The traveler is suspicious as hell, and our nobleman walks right into this huge nest of complications. Everything from dragon riders chasing them to having to kidnap and lie his way across three countries. So I do have a short selection from the manuscript. In this particular scene, we're following two characters named Sikora and Callista. They are two dragon riders from a neighboring nation, and they're here to attend an ice elf dinner party. Their patrol has been tracking the main character's party, and as a result of some events that occurred previously, they are now trapped in this ice elf city by magic. And the goal of this scene is that they have to negotiate with the queen in order to get their patrol released from the city. Sikora, who is our viewpoint character, struggles to stay afloat amid all these foreign customs, while at the same time having to speak in a language that doesn't permit lying, until she can speak with the queen. This is one of my personal favorite scenes because I loved and had so much fun writing the subtle viciousness of the ice elf court and culture. It's just, oddly enough, a joy to write. So without further ado, this is a short reading from Chapter 7 of Prisoner of Fate. Still standing, the queen took an empty glass and raised it. I welcome you, my guests, to table. Satsarandar. Snow poured down silently above them. It drifted into the upraised glasses, filling them with clear water. As pure as new snow, called the queen. And as clear as ice, the host replied. Everyone drank, and Sikora sipped slowly, the freezing water sending lancing pain through her teeth. The hubbub of clinking glasses and chatter returned. The serving children brought out trays of small plates, which the ice elves grabbed and handed across the table. The ice elf across the table then offered the food to those seated around him, usually first eating one piece himself. There was no silver anywhere, and the ice elves ate with their fingers. Sikora found the whole process disorienting. More than once, Edra elbowed her hard as she twisted to reach for a plate. The matronly ice elf appeared determined to school her in etiquette. The ice elf on Sikora's left held a plate under the guild woman's nose. These sweetmeats are quite savory. Take a bite, Edra ordered, and comment on how delicious it is or how unusual, and then offer me a piece. Sikora complied. It's quite tender, she said politely, but the ice elf had already turned away. It doesn't mean anything, Sikora, it's just courtesy. Edra plucked a sweetmeat from the plate and licked her fingers. Delicious. If you're taking a drink of water, you're excused the plate. What? Drink your water. Sikora turned to pick up her glass and found the other ice elf waving another plate. The guildswoman gripped the goblet assertively and raised it. Oh, pardon me. The ice elf removed the plate. Sikora sipped her water. Edra smiled. Someone may call you respectable before the night is through. Sikora checked on Callista and saw a two-handed silver bowl being passed along the table. When it reached an elf, he would hold it while his neighbor reached inside and pulled something small and sparkling out. The bowl reached Evrast, who passed it to Callista. She saw the Storm Rider's face register surprise as he reached in and pulled out a crystal spoon. Callista passed the bowl to the queen, who watched with great interest as Callista withdrew a crystal spoon of her own, and Sikora realized the spoons weren't crystal. They were ice. The bowl was filled with water, and the ice elves were transforming it with elemental magic. The queen passed the bowl to the handsome man on her left. That's Narukoi, the royal consort, Edra whispered as the queen withdrew her hand. Narukoi was sweating. The chatter at the table quieted as heads turned to watch. He must have been poisoned. Poisoned? Oh, just witchlock. How embarrassing. Sakura's blood ran cold. A tincture that worked like a hex, creeping into the blood and binding up ether, sapping one's magical energy. For someone with elemental magic like the Ice Elves or Callista, it could be lethal. Narukoi looked unwell and deeply unhappy. Edra watched with unabashed interest. If he can't make his ice, he must ask the queen to... Oh my. Narukoi turned awkwardly to his neighbor, who squirmed before passing the bowl and plucking out two spoons, one for himself and one for Narukoi. The queen watched impassively, but Edra shook her head. That was ill done. Sakura warded off more offers of food with judicious sips of water as the bowl progressed. She tried to formulate an incantation to freeze water in the shape of a spoon and convince it to remain in such an unnatural shape. She could do what Narukoi had done, she supposed, but who'd ask? Edra. And then Edra was handing Sakura the bowl. She looked down as Edra reached in, watching white stars break the clear surface, crystallize, then clarify once again into smooth, flawless ice. It wasn't a spoon. Or rather, it was a spoon, but with a bold belly and a tined edge. If there was a word in the old tongue to name it, Sakura had never learned it. She passed the bowl to her left, racking her brain. Tine spoon. Ice spoon. Spoon fork? Sakura reached into the bowl and wiggled her numb fingers. Miraculously, she struck something solid. She maintained a carefully neutral expression and withdrew a spoon. She set it next to her goblet and took a sip of water before she risked a glance up the table, where the queen was looking on approvingly. Next to the queen, Callista winked. It was all beginning to make sense, or at least she felt less at sea. One would taste a food and then offer it to one's neighbors, proclaiming how delicious or savory. The foods were all sipped from the ice spoons or speared upon their tines, and the ice elves ate nearly as many bites from their neighbors' spoons as their own. The water glass remained sacred, and she employed its power liberally. She could almost appreciate the traditions. Rigid, transparent, impeccably polite, each ice elf tied to his neighbors like climbers on a sheer wall of ice. And all around them, the thrumming of 1,000 tiny spells, allowing no falsehood. Sakura took a sip of wine and watched Narukoi. The queen was feeding her lover tiny salted fish from her own plate, offering a bite and then snatching the spoon away to eat it herself, laughing. He laughed too, radiant with her affection. She taunted him with another morsel, and this time he grabbed her wrist, kissed her breathless mouth, and ate the fish from her spoon. He swallowed. He opened his mouth, but no words came out. Narukoi let go of the queen's wrist to tug at his collar. He stared at the queen, mouth still half laughing, but she was watching him with a mischievous smile. His eyes shifted from her face to her spoon, to her plate, to his wine glass, to the faces watching. The royal consort reached for his water, but knocked the chalice over. The queen caught it, giving a hauntingly sweet giggle. Narukoi gripped her wrist, his expression shifting from adoration to fear to a blank stare. Sakura's jaw dropped. She forced her gaze to a skewer of red meat being waved at her by the ice elf across the table. Ice bear, vicious creatures, but such tender meat. She clung to her water glass, a life raft in the fog of shock. Edra, I think Narukoi has been poisoned. Edra cast an expert glance up the table. Twice in one night? Very tidily, too. Did you see it? Sakura nodded curtly, and Edra leaned closer. Did you see his last bite? From the queen herself. She was about to eat it, but he took it from her own spoon. Oh, Sakura, Edra smiled now, looking deeply satisfied. This more than makes up for the nonsense you witnessed earlier. It was a shame you had to see that. The queen gestured at a pair of servers. Her voice carried above the clamor. Put Narukoi in the courtyard for the remainder of the evening, should anyone like to examine his body. Edra patted Sakura's hand. You'll sit with the queen soon. Don't embarrass me, cousin. As predicted, a server soon relayed the queen's request that Sakura take the vacant seat. Your highness is a most gracious host, Sakura said as she took the seat. Narukoi's plate and ice spoon were still on the table. She suspected she was meant to eat from them, to demonstrate confidence that they weren't poisoned, but the thought made her sick. Fortunately, the trenchers were being cleared away, and a quartet of young musicians approached the high table. A quiet tune began. Some ice elves rose and mingled, while others remained seated in small groups. I hope that you will share the sweet course with me, cousin, the queen said. How could I refuse? But you must excuse my ignorance of your customs. Sakura watched Callista and Evrast walk the room together. The queen chuckled. It's quite simple. I choose three plates. You choose one for me, and I choose one of the remaining two to give to another guest, whom you choose. The third plate is yours. simple, but loaded with meaning. And in this tangled theater, there must be countless ways to flatter or offend. And we must discuss the unpleasant business of your acts of war in the Low City. Sakura kept her breathing even, her tone contrite, with the weight of the old tongue's honesty behind her words. No act of war was intended, Your Highness. Nonetheless, an army camps within my walls. Why? We're hunting a dangerous man, an enemy of our realm. We tracked him to your city. An enemy of your realm need not be an enemy of mine. One man doesn't concern me, nor should you concern yourself with what he does beyond your borders. The queen waved a hand, and three plates appeared before them. Sakura blinked as she tried to remember the rules. Madness. Kingdom's on the brink of war, and I'm worried about how to eat dessert properly. On each plate sat a fat disc of something. One disc was glossy white, topped with spun sugar. One was gold, with piped embellishment, and the third was black. Sakura pushed the white disc toward the queen. Its color reminds me of your fair complexion. May it be as pure as your soul. The queen laughed, her eyes glinting. How very couth, cousin. In truth, it's my favorite. She touched the edge of the golden plate. Yellow is an unlucky color, a poor omen for diplomacy. Someone else will enjoy this. Evrast Adrelic, Sakura suggested. I'm told he's unusually fortunate, despite his hair. Perhaps it will be lucky for him. The queen gave the plate to a server. When Evrast bowed in their direction, she raised her water glass in a silent toast. Sakura pulled the black dish closer. She watched as the queen plucked the spun sugar from her dish and nibbled it. Your Highness, what is the price of our safe passage? Bring me a dragon's egg, the queen said, smiling broadly, and you shall have safe passage to the ends of my realm for you and all your riders. The queen's voice shivered with power. It was true, an egg would buy them peace, but if that was the cost, they would be waiting a long time. I don't have that authority, my queen, and those with such authority will never, never allow it. A pity. She cracked the white disc on her plate with the edge of her spoon, releasing a clear green jelly. She sipped it, staining her lips. I wonder, authority or no, can you imagine anything that would persuade you to bring me an egg? Sakura can imagine a great many things. She cracked the top of the black disc, and a wine-red jelly poured out, steaming in the frozen air. She lifted Narukoi's spoon to her lips and tasted it, sweet and warm and coppery, and far too much like blood.
There you have it, a reading from Prisoner of Fate. Thank you, Danielle, for reading that for us. I don't know, I think hearing that scene, that was really neat because I felt like I was in the scene. I mean, and that's sort of a testament to how rich of a world that you've created. I mean, we get a really strong feel for the culture, or we have a really great idea of the relationships that exist between these characters. And I also really liked the whole idea behind the spoon fork. That was a nice touch. In my head, I was immediately like, just call it a spork. But I was like, oh no.
Exactly. It's a spork.
Yeah, I was like, that's the joke, isn't it? That's the joke. And I was like, ah, yes, good one. So really great. Thank you for sharing that with all of us.
Thank you for having me and letting me share it.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you have any last words of wisdom or advice that you'd like to send in the direction of our listeners before we wrap this one up?
I guess I would just say that the writing game is all about perseverance. You have to keep yourself motivated and you have to keep your head in the game and recognize that, you know, if you really want this, you can make it happen, but it might take some time. I mean, for me, like I said, for me, it took 14 years and that is an awfully long time, but it's definitely doable. You know, you can't give up. You can't let rejection get to you. You can't let the hardships along the way take you down. You just have to keep moving forward, keep plowing ahead, and surrounding yourself with people who will cheer you on as you do.
I think that's some great advice to end on. So thank you, Danielle Maurer, for being part of this episode.
Absolutely, Ryan. It was an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to listening to more episodes of your podcast.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that as well.
There you have it, another interview in the books. Thanks again to Danielle for being on the show, and thanks as always to you listeners for tuning in and rating the show on the iTunes and the Google Play stores. If you like what you heard from Danielle today, then do I have good news for you. Danielle will be returning to the Writescast in October as part of a month-long mini-series on preparing for National Novel Writing Month when it begins in November. I know I'm excited to have her on the show again, and I hope you're excited to hear from her again, too. Looking forward to future episodes of the Writescast, July 21st will feature award-winning author Valerie Beal for a conversation on how to promote your work via traditional media like radio, TV, and the news. And on August 4th, we'll hear from author Stephen Salmon about his experience as an author with cerebral palsy. One final note to you, dear listeners, if you have a topic you'd love to learn more about or speak to on the RightsCast itself, please feel free to reach out to me on Twitter at @IMRRCampbell or through the contact page on my website at rrcampbellrights.com. There are only a couple of interview slots available for 2017, so be sure to reach out as soon as you're able if you'd like to be on the show before the year ends. That's all for now, but thank you once again for joining me for this episode. The show simply wouldn't be what it is if it weren't for listeners like you. So, until next time, write on and write well.